In his great commentary on the Gospel of Matthew, Dale Bruner writes that this arrest, we see that one disciple betrays Jesus, another disciple foolishly defends Jesus, and finally all the disciples flee Jesus, teaching us the total human undependability. First of all, in all of the ordeals of Christ, of Christ's own church, which is to say, out of the gate, the first thing we learn is that those closest to Jesus, not the ones in competition with him, are the ones who fail him. We learn this through Judas and through Peter and through the disciples, and we'll learn more about them as we go along, but this is kind of the beginning salvo. And the crowd that comes into the garden that evening to address Jesus is led by Judas, one who Matthew names one of the 12. Notice how he names him that way. Judas, one of the 12. He was one of the original chosen by Jesus to be his followers. He was one who walked along with Jesus every step of his life, daily witnessing the miraculous deeds of Jesus, particularly in those 3 years. He heard daily the wisdom and the truth from a teacher unlike any other, the one the crowd says was like any other teacher they'd ever seen or witnessed. He daily prayed with his friends, his disciples, over daily bread. He was trained to proclaim the good news. He was sent out into the world to teach it, to live it, to confront evil. And yet he turned away when the temptation was great. 30 pieces of silver was his price. We don't know why. Text never tells us. Was it for money? He was, you know, the keeper of the purse. Was it growing disappointment that Jesus wasn't quite the Messiah that he had been hoping for? Was it the allure of power that somehow he could have a connection to the big bosses in the temple now that Jesus really wasn't following through? We don't know. What is clear from the text is that disciples today can be traitors tomorrow. To be with Jesus is not to be spared the temptations of sin. To walk with Christ is not to be spared the realities of evil. Judas probably talked a good game. He probably spoke about the faith well. He probably prayed pretty good prayers. And the disciples didn't even see this coming. Couldn't they have sniffed out a traitor in their midst as it developed? Evil is often disguised, and it attacks those, even with the closest proximity to the truth. And Judas failed with an utmost indignity, a kiss on the cheek. Greetings, hail, rabbi. Rabbi, a word that the disciples never use for Jesus in the Gospel of Matthew. It's only used by the opponents of Jesus. And Jesus responds in a phrase notoriously difficult to translate. You'll find many translations with differing understandings of this text, but I think this one makes the best sense of the context. Friend, do what you came to do. He had already known about this event and had told Judas it was going to be happening at the Last Supper. And Christian history has proven this point again and again and again, that the most damaging offenses to the Christian faith often don't come from its most ardent enemies, but from those closest to the truth, who enter in the fall in the realm of deception. As C.S. Lewis once said, those closest to the truth are the ones who have the farthest to fall. Now Peter. Now Judas isn't Jesus' only problem. It's not those who sell out who cause the most damage. But as Dale Bruner points out, Jesus' overzealous followers in Christian history have often been as painful to him. The identification here is muted. Matthew doesn't tell us that it's Peter. We learn that from, I believe, Mark. He just says one of those with Jesus. We have one of the 12. Judas came in the garden. Now we have one of those who were with Jesus. That is to say, it wasn't the betrayer. Now it was the remaining 11 in the garden. One of those with Jesus decides to take action. And this one who was with Jesus takes out a sword and literally relieves a man of his ear. From a fencing standpoint, I've always wondered if that was a good shot or a bad miss. Text doesn't tell us. You might think, what's wrong with the impulse there? Defense, right? Well, as Brunner continues, he says, disciples who trust their own instincts and their behavior too much, who are too sure that Jesus must admire anything they do to serve and defend him, or who think that the salvation of sinners and the liberation of the innocent justifies any means at all, are taught by this gospel to think again. We can and we must debate the use of the sword in government and law enforcement, even in self-defense. The book of Romans in the 13th chapter allows for the government to use the sword for the restraining of evil. But in Jesus' words, the place of the sword is never in defense of a gospel. We must keep those two things very clearly separate. That the cause of Jesus Christ is never answered with that taking up of the sword. The sword is for the restraining of evil. It's protection of the innocent. They are separate things. And Jesus makes it clear to Peter. He says, listen, have you not got the point yet? I could have called down legions upon legions of angels to defend me. And it should have been clear to Peter that the one who had miraculously calmed the storm, a natural sea storm, could protect himself in the midst of the garden with a few buffoons with weapons. The larger point, though, is that Peter's behavior isn't innocent here. Three times Jesus had told his disciples what was going to happen. First time he told his disciples what was going to happen, Peter pulled Jesus aside and said, dude, you've got to stop talking this way. Messiah doesn't do this. And Peter gets the most stark rebuke in all of the Gospels. Get behind me, Satan. You do not have in mind the things of God, but the things of men. And what is happening here in the garden is that it is something that is not in accordance with Peter's will. His own understanding of the way it ought to be is being hijacked. And he decides to take his own will and pulls the sword. Christian history is littered with those ardent and faithful followers of Christ who, in many ways, have baptized their own wills in the place of God's. It doesn't need to be in an example like this. We can think of numerous ways in which we have, even in more seemingly peaceful demonstrations, proclaimed a will that was ours and not God's. And these people have lopped off more than a few ears, living out the gospel that does not draw people to the mercy of God, but to a false gospel of self-fulfillment or power or might that crushes the weak, that lives to destroy enemies rather than convert them, a gospel that embodies my will in my time by my means rather than God's will and God's time and God's means. We could have a history lesson on the disasters of that very mission statement. My will, my means, my time. And now to the disciples. Following Jesus, setting in motion Judas' betrayal and Peter's folly, the disciples flee. They all run away. Jesus would face his trial alone. There would be none of his followers who would stand by his side in captivity with chains on them, who would say, yeah, I am with him. When the chains were put on Jesus, it is now every man for himself. And the irony here is that literally 21 verses prior to this scene, following Peter's declaration that he would die with Jesus rather than deny him, which is what he will shortly do, actually. The disciples said that they would never flee. Though Jesus had said, because of me, you will all soon flee. And the question there is asked, where is the human strength necessary to keep one's word? Literally a few hours from saying, I'll never do that, to, I just did that. Have you been there? This entire text from Matthew 26 is the outplaying of the first few verses of Romans chapter 2. It is really a collision course in which people who are confident in themselves, the one, Judas, who will do anything necessary to get power, Peter, the one who baptizes his own will, disciples, the one who says they would never flee but actually do, is showing the reality of human nature as it is. Where Paul says, those of you who do the same things, how is it that you condemn those who do the very same things that you do? Some of us are like Judas, and we want to be on the end game, and we'll compromise when the going gets hard. Some of us are like Peter. We want our will to be done at any cost. And some of us are like the disciples. Our word can't be trusted. Maybe all of us are like all of them. And yet what seems so utterly tragic in terms of the complete failure of those closest to Jesus to keep their word, to be who they were called to be, Jesus is the one in the midst of it, is in complete control. The one who says to Judas, friend, do what you came to do. This is not a surprise to me. The one who says to Peter, after the sword incident, he says to his disciples, how then will the scriptures be fulfilled? That it must be so. And the disciples, prior to them fleeing and running away, Jesus saying to everybody gathered there, this has taken place that the scriptures and the prophets might be fulfilled. One of the scriptures he had used at 21 verses earlier was Zechariah 13:7, that the shepherd will be struck and the sheep of the flock will be scattered, and that scattering will be for an important purpose. Jesus knew what the disciples would do, and they had done it. Not because it was a self-fulfilling prophecy, because he knew the depths of the reality of human nature that was leading him to the cross. At no point in his journey was there going to be an aha moment where just maybe they may get it right this time and I don't have to do it. The utter essence of the cross is that it was our only hope. There was no other way. There was no other backdoor route. There was no other possibility that those closest to him who would be taught his words, who would be sent out with his power, would somehow get it right. There was only one way. All of the good intentions of even the best of humanity couldn't remedy the situation in which we find ourselves. And because of that, he went to the cross. And therefore, we say this morning that there is no hope for betrayers. There is no hope for those who constantly put their own will in place of the Lord's. There is no hope for those who abandon their word when they swear they won't do it. Unless Jesus himself would go to the cross and give his life as a remedy for that failure. For Jesus was not tempted by the money and the power of the world. Would never sell his friends short and sell it out. Jesus never substituted his will for that of the Lord's, though he prayed for it. He said, is there another way? Show me the way. But nevertheless, what? Not my will, but yours be done. And Jesus didn't abandon his word. He never said, whoops. He never turned his back on the people he came to save. And therefore, this heartfelt understanding of the gospel of Jesus Christ, if it was truly to become part of who we are, and it has to start at the humiliating level of Romans 2 and Matthew 26. If we had been there, it would not have been different. But because Jesus was deeply in control, his death forgave and wipe clean those very sins that those closest to him perpetrated. That is a depth of forgiveness that we can only begin to wade into. And therefore we say, there but for the grace of God go I. I invite you to participate in the taking of the Lord's Supper this morning. But it can only happen in humility of who we are and the failures of our own lives. The disciples were never sent out into the world to do amazing things following his resurrection without them being confronted by Jesus in the realities of their own sins. And in their despair, he lifted them up. Come and believe that what we remember here today is the death on our behalf for our sins of betrayal, presumption, and abandonment. Receive the mercy of the Lord this morning in this supper. Please be seated as we sing the first three songs, or the verses of Just As I Am.